The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I am Hugh Hewitt. The names atop the roster of world powers see China moving up at a staggering pace. How critical is our own Navy as a deterrent?
So there's a historical predisposition of great powers to go to war when one is rising and one is established.
Democratic candidates for president are multiplying like rabbits, with each newcomer trying to out-radical their predecessors.
It is clearly an imperfect, unfair, unjust, and racist capitalist economy.
How does the president's emergency declaration square with precedent and the Constitution?
The president is absolutely within his authority. The president, in invoking the National Emergencies Act, has done what every president since 1976 has done.
Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, repeated elsewhere later in the day and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. With budget negotiations underway, the Navy has announced the retirement of the USS Harry Truman, a nuclear carrier, to be put into mothballs well before its time. Anyone who closely follows our naval strength relative to our previous and strategic dominance is flabbergasted by this decision. This news drove me to a frequent guest on my program, retired Admiral James Stav Reedy, formerly the commander of NATO. He's now with the Carlyle Group, but before he commanded NATO, he was also the commander of Southern Command. He retired after 37 years of service, 11 of them at sea. What do you think is going on with the Truman, and what do you make of the decision of the attempt to retire it at half its life?
It is all about the Benjamins, to quote a famous member of Congress lately.
Yeah.
It's about the money. And it is a bad decision, in my view. Certainly, you want to be able to maintain and keep all of your ships at the highest level of readiness. To do that, you can't operate as many of them. But these aircraft carriers are crucial to our national security. It's a mistake to take the Truman out. She has a ton of life left in her. She could go another 20 years easy with a normal mid-cycle refueling for, I know it sounds like a lot, a couple of billion dollars, but that's the best bargain you could make for U.S. national security. You know this, Hugh, but the first question every president asks in a crisis is, where are the carriers?
They are the strategic asset without parallel. What do you think of that argument?
I think that's a very powerful argument. Let's do the numbers for 1 second. Each of these ships has 80 combat aircraft on them. Their combat radius through which they can conduct power strikes is 1,500 miles. They can move 750 miles a day. They're highly mobile. And also, we don't just put them out there, anchor them as sitting ducks. They're on the move constantly. They're surrounded by missile defense ships, anti-submarine ships. And before we brought them close enough for enemy assets to engage them, we would be using our long-range bombers, our cruise missiles, to knock down enemy defenses. So they're not invulnerable. Ships can be sunk in combat. We know that from the Falkland Island War.
Now let me go to China. It is dizzying to go to Vietnam, Malaysia, the Kingdom of Brunei, to Vietnam for a long time, and then end up in Hong Kong. So dizzying, but also a wake-up call for everyone. And I want to talk to you about China and what do you view them as? This is, I think, the most important strategic relationship of the next 100 years, the United States and China. Do you agree with that?
I would argue, in the end, in this century, our interests are going to converge more than we think as we sit here at this moment. But it will require careful diplomacy to ensure we don't get into a war with China. If you look at history, and this is what Graham Allison does, over the past 2,000 years, there have been 16 times in which an established power, like the United States, is challenged by a rising power, like China. In 12 of those 16 instances, a global war follows. Most recently, World War I. Established power Great Britain, rising power, Germany. So there's a historical predisposition of great powers to go to war when one is rising and one is established. Secondly, with China, they have a global vision, one belt, one road, they call it, to create a mercantile empire that stretches from China to Africa to the Asian continent and on to Europe. When you combine those two things, you could see where our macro interests are threatened, and the flashpoint to you is where you traveled. It's the South China Sea, which China claims is a territorial body of water. That is the flashpoint that could ignite a global war. We can avoid that, but it's going to require attention and engagement in order to do so.
The number of Democratic presidential candidates is, at least for today, 15 and counting. This does not include those like Joe Biden, who will almost certainly run. One of the most recent signers on is former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke. As a candidate, Beto appears to have taken on a Kennedy-esque mystique among many. However, the assessment of others, including some Democrats, conclude that with Beto, there's just no there. Here's my colleague Mike Gallagher, a former Texan, observing Beto's performance on last Sunday's Meet the Press.
He was on Meet the Press over the weekend. I'm watching this Meet the Press conversation, and to hear a guy who looks the part, and let's face it, he's a very attractive, charismatic guy. You know, he's got it for all. He got young people like his skateboards. Do you really want a president who believes capitalism is racism? Here's Beto, a.k.a. Robert Francis O'Rourke, on Meet the Press. Grabian's cut and Meet the Press. Cut three.
I consider myself a capitalist. I started a small business in 1999 in El Paso, Texas, with some good friends. Was able to secure some great clients, do some good work, really do something in El Paso, Texas, a high-skill, high-tech, high-wage business that wasn't expected. And as I made the point earlier, I think the only way to meet some of these historic challenges is to be able to use this engine of capitalism. It won't be government intervention or policy alone that makes it possible. Now, having said that, it is clearly an imperfect, unfair, unjust, and racist capitalist economy.
I just cannot imagine that Americans want to go down that path of a guy who's so radical and so far left that he thinks that our capitalist system in 2019 America is racist because it favors evidently white people. This is what leads to the insanity, for example, in Newark. I see this headline. Check this out. The mayor of Newark, New Jersey says the city is going to study a pilot program that provides a universal basic income. This statement was made the other night during the mayor's annual State of the City address. The city has actually launched a task force. They're spending money in Newark, New Jersey, to study a program that pays everybody, whether they work or not. Now, to take an idea that says, listen, you don't want to work, it's all right, we're going to give you a check anyway. We'll give you a paycheck. This is progressivism on steroids. No merit, no justification, just everybody gets paid. Everybody gets money. Money that, of course, comes from taxpayers who do work. Reminds me of reparations. Non-black citizens who are going to be expected to pay black citizens because of the evils of slavery. So in this case, The argument for universal basic income, or the way it works, people who work get taxed and have to pay people who don't. You think that's normal? You think that's okay?
Last week we touched on a more recent campaign item, reparations, which has many of the candidates piling on. Beto has been quiet on this score, but he'll likely be forced to get out there soon. Here's my friend and colleague Dennis Prager with his thoughts on reparations.
Yesterday's front page in USA Today was, we don't teach slavery enough in our schools. I was talking elementary schools, the details about slavery. I think everybody, I've said this for my whole life, everyone needs to know about slavery. It depends how you teach it. you'll hear Elizabeth Warren calling for reparations. The better things get for all Americans, the greater the screaming about how bad it is. That's the rule. Because the day if Americans could take a wake-up pill and realize how good things are in the United States of America, that's the end of the Democratic Party and the end of the left. You get it? It is an amazing thing. Last night, CNN Town Hall.
America was founded on principles of liberty and freedom and on the backs of slave labor. And we're not going to fix that. We're not going to change that until we address it head on directly. I believe it's time to start the national, full-blown conversation about reparations in this country.
The reason for the gap is racism. That 80% of black kids are born to an unwed mother, no, you can't even mention that. It was a liberal Democrat, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Senator of New York State, who originally wrote about and called attention to the out-of-wedlock birth rate in black life in America. It was a liberal Democrat. Daniel Patrick Moynihan today would be considered a right-wing Republican. This division is immense. The tragedy, it is the tragedy. Liberals are cowards. The enemy of liberalism, excuse me, is not conservatism. It is leftism. The gap between median white family income and black family income owes to discrimination. I'd be very interested to know if what the story is with regard to Africans who have immigrated to the United States in the last 40 years. You know, more Africans have come to the United States voluntarily than came as slaves. This was true in the 1980s already. And that's, 40 years ago. She's a piece of work, but she's no different. The whole gang is. I don't think, is there anybody, any Democrat running who's not calling for reparations?
Coming up.
The president is absolutely within his authority. A lot of people are making a mistake of believing that the president has exceeded executive authority under the Constitution, which isn't the case at all. The president, in invoking the National Emergencies Act, has done what every president since 1976 has done in the sense of using the act. And in this particular instance, we need to recognize that this is a congressional act.
Is there precedent for the president's emergency declaration? When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I am Hugh Hewitt. The program is brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Shortly after he lost the wall funding battle to the tune of $4 billion, the president did what he said he would do. He made an emergency declaration. The Senate, with help from 12 senators from Mr. Trump's side of the aisle, voted against that declaration. Were they justified? Since then, the president, of course, vetoed the attempt by Congress to block the declaration. I spoke recently on my show with a sharp state attorney general, Curtis Hill of Indiana. Let's start with the emergency declaration. What's your position on the president's invocation of the 1976 authority?
The president is absolutely within his authority. A lot of people are making a mistake of believing that the president has exceeded executive authority under the Constitution, which isn't the case at all. The president, in invoking the National Emergencies Act, has done what every president since 1976 has done in the sense of using the act. And in this particular instance, we need to recognize that this is a congressional act. This is legislation that directly provides the president of the United States with authority to declare an emergency. And that emergency declaration is not defined by Congress. It's within the discretion of the president. So Whether or not someone agrees or not is an entirely different matter, but the fact remains that the President of the United States does have the authority to make a declaration of an emergency. And if you look at the basis of that, we clearly have a crisis at the southern border made primarily by Congress's inaction over the last several decades to address the issue.
And, General, I got to tell you, I teach con law at Chapman the first quarter of the year. And I go to them, I say to them, you might not like this emergency declaration, but this law has been used, I think, 36 times by presidents since 1976. And it's a delegation of legislative authority to the executive, which I'm not a big fan of, but it exists in the law. This is not a constitutional crisis.
That's exactly right. And if Congress doesn't like what they did, guess what? Congress has the ability to go back in and do something different. The fact remains that it's there. It's authority provided the president by Congress, and he's used it properly.
Okay. Have you taken this position in court, by the way? Have the Hoosiers gone into court to side with the president in the challenges to his invocation?
We've not yet gone into the court. In fact, we've looked at the challenges. We think they're meritless. So we're waiting to see what occurs moving forward, but we're certainly watching the situation.
All right. Now I want to move to an issue that was pioneered by your pal in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro. Now, Josh is a Democrat. We still like him anyway. You're a Republican. Josh is a Democrat. We like him anyway because he got the Pennsylvania grand jury to get serious about, and I'm Roman Catholic. I went to a Catholic high school. I'm as Catholic as the day is long. I am very upset with my church. I'm very glad that Josh Shapiro has blown the doors off of this in six of the dioceses where the bishop had not moved. What are you doing about this in Indiana?
Well, first of all, let me say that Josh Shapiro is an excellent attorney general. He's a colleague and a friend. We've done some things together, so I applaud what he's done. In Indiana, we're taking a look at the situation. We have different jurisdictional powers in the various states in terms of our AG's offices. And one of the basis for what we've done, which is established a web page to provide support for potential victims of clergy abuse. And we did that as a result of what was going on in Pennsylvania and other states. We want to make sure that in Indiana we have a clearinghouse for information to come in. It's very important to me to recognize the balance of our concern about what appears to be going on as an institution, an institutional problem, along with the interest of fairness. So we want to make sure that we secure information on what the potential of this is in Indiana and provide the appropriate avenues. If we find criminal activity in particular instances, we'll direct those to the local prosecutors. But we're also very concerned about the institutional issue. Is there a major issue of clergy abuse within the Catholic Church or any church within the state of Indiana, and is it being covered up through an institutional process? That's the real concern that we're seeing nationally and internationally, the failure of the institution to police itself and therefore provide the confidence that parishioners deserve.
For my complete interview with Attorney General Hill, go to townhallreview.com. If there was ever any doubt, the left has a history of anti-Semitism, but not so much in the United States. Now, however, it is showing up among Democrats in our Congress most conspicuously in the form of Ilhan Omar. Omar was one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress and has made several remarks that are not even subtly anti-Semitic. They're outrageously, grossly anti-Semitic. My Salem colleague Sebastian Gorka spoke with Leo Leibovitz, journalist, author, and media critic who is also an Israeli citizen.
I'd like our audience to think about an article you've recently written. They've all heard of hormone replacement treatment. You've written an article called Progressive Replacement Theology. What is that about? Explain the article to our listeners, please.
So the idea here is kind of, you know, fascinating and kind of dreadful. The Christian church in the millennia since has gotten much, much wiser and much more subtle and much more welcoming about this issue, but something really interesting is happening to the left, which is weirdly, because I think so much of progressivism is this kind of, you know, odd death cult, they've adopted this notion that if they're the new chosen people, if they're the bearers of all that is good and right in the world, well, they have a problem with the previous people, once again, who held the standard, which is why you hear so many people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, coming out and saying, well, you know, I may be a Jew. It's now the kind of standard that the left wants, of course, replacing the actual Jews, disregarding their actual problems, and treating them just as vilely and anti-Semitically as you know, the Inquisition did. But it's the same idea.
Is the new anti-Semitism simply being anti-Israeli? Are things like the BDS movement and being rabidly anti-Israel, is that the new politically correct way of being an anti-Semite?
I learned a really interesting lesson about 2 years ago, and it involves you, and it tells you everything you need to know about these people. So when you accepted your position in the White House, I didn't know who you were. And all of a sudden, those wonderful people on the left come out and say, without a trace of civility or shame or adherence to anything that's right and factual and sacred, that you are a Nazi. And I was completely shocked and taken aback that anyone could be so noxious, so crude, and so disrespectful of the actual suffering of actual Jews, to use this tool as this kind of disgusting political hammer to kind of batter at people that you disagreed with politically. And it should surprise you not at all that the same people who have no regard for actual Jewish suffering also have no ability to look at anti-Semites like the BDS movement, like Ilhan Omar, like Rashida Tlaib, and very simply come out and say, we condemn this.
But how did this happen? Because if you go back to 1947, 1948, we were on the side of the survivors. As a nation, America was on the side of the survivors of the Holocaust. Israel was our friend, was our partner. We supported them.
You know, I think Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer are asking themselves the exact same question right now. I think they're terrified. I think all of a sudden they're besotted by this onslaught of progressive candidates who frankly have very, very, very different beliefs.
Coming up, they have got 27,500 applicants for these specialized schools. About 5,500 of them are black. Only 7 got into STI. I take a look at de facto segregation in New York when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I am Hugh Hewitt. If you listen to the Hugh Hewitt Show, which airs daily on the Salem Radio Network live from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, later in the day on other affiliates, you don't hear a lot of extended monologues from me. But a few days ago, a report in the New York Times upset me. It turns out that the Stuyvesant High School, one of the most highly selective New York City high schools, perhaps the most prestigious one of them all, only admitted 7 African Americans to its incoming freshman class. That's out of a class total of 895. 7 out of 895 from my program earlier this week. New York has a bunch of very highly selective high schools where everyone competes to get in on the basis of one test. And David Axelrod went to STI. A lot of people went to it. And it would be a nightmare, right? If you had to get into a particular high school and you're in all of Manhattan and Bronx and the Queens and you're trying really hard to get into one of these high schools, it would be a nightmare. You would freak out over that test. Now, I just went to John F. Kennedy High School because it was a Catholic school and I could go. And, you know, it cost $350 a year in the 70s. And so I could go. And it was a great high school. But if you're in New York, you've got to test into these high schools. Here is the story this morning from Eliza Shapiro in the New York Times. Only a tiny number of black students were offered admission to the highly selective public high schools in New York on Monday, raising the pressure on officials to confront the decades-old challenge of integrating New York's elite public schools. I did not know this until this morning. I did not know that New York's elite public schools were segregated. They are. Now, it's de facto segregation, not de jure segregation. It's not because they intended to be segregated. It's because they used this test. At Stuyvesant High School, out of 895 slots in the freshman class, it's a big high school. It's got, you know, obviously 4,000 people. Only 7 were offered to black students out of 895 in the city of New York. That is, last year they only had 10 black kids
at Stuyvesant. The year before, 13. It's down to 7 out of 895 slots. Another highly selective specialized school, the Bronx High School of Science, made 12 offers to black students, down from 25 last year. The New York Times said students gain entry into specialized schools by acing a single high-stakes exam that tests their mastery of math and English. So Dwayne's not getting in. Some students spend months or even years preparing for the exam. Stuyvesant, the most selective of the schools, has the highest cutoff score for admission and now has the lowest percentage of black and Hispanic students of any of New York's roughly 600 public high schools. So my question to you is, what do you do about this? Anything? I'm teaching the race cases today to my con law students. All right, so I'm teaching the difference between de jure and de facto discrimination. De jure means that old Jim Crow, when separate was equal and they could force African-Americans not to use the same bathrooms, the same water fountains, the same swimming pools, that was de jure segregation. De facto segregation is what happens when people self-select the neighborhoods they live in and they become racially dominant in one or another of the race groups. They have got 27,500 applicants for these specialized schools. About 5,500 of them are black. And only 7 got into Stuy. That's out of 4,800 students admitted into specialized schools, 190 are black. Just 190. What do you do about that? What do you do? I'm a big meritocracy believer. I believe in tests. But I do not know that that is just. When a city with that many African-American kids, and I think it's 70,000. I can't find that number now. And you get a grand total of 7 offers. 7 in a class of 895. Something is wrong with that test. Now, you wonder who got in. I'm going to tell you. 65%. I'm reading the graph backward. 65% of the students admitted to Stuyvesant High School are Asian American. 22% are white. 11% are other. And only 7 are black. 7 total. Not 7%, 7 total. What do you do about that? Something's wrong with that system. These are stunning numbers. New York City's public high school system, its selective high schools, are segregated. I think we need to find a way to bring meritocracy in line with potential, not test scores. I don't know how to do that. It's genuinely a question. I do not know how to do that. But this is very disturbing coming up.
I mean, the amazing thing to me, Hugh, I mean, to talk about how poisoned we are, 1 in 6 Americans have stopped talking to a family member or close friend because of politics.
Arthur Brooks, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Arthur Brooks is an economist and a philosopher and much more. He will soon join the faculty at Harvard Business School, the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, as a professor of the practice of public leadership. But for the past 10 years, Arthur has served as the president of the American Enterprise Institute, a veritable treasure of a think tank in Washington, D.C. He's also filled in for me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. He's been a frequent guest, and he is a dear friend. We spoke recently about Arthur's new book, Love Your Enemy. I want to begin by asking you a question on a publishing side. How much effort did it take to get your publishers to agree to the title Love Your Enemies?
Believe it or not, after a lot of discussions with the publisher, it was the publisher at Broadside Books at HarperCollins who said, well, why don't we just call it Love Your Enemies? That's what you're talking about, right? So not that much work.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Now I have a story to tell you.
Pushing it through the market.
You are a big proponent of story in the book Love Your Enemies. So I have a story for you. Yesterday I was traveling with Professor Mrs. Hewitt, actually 2 days ago, back from Oakland, where we had been in San Francisco to see Hamilton. In a very crowded airport lounge for frequent flyers, a very loud man who may or may not have recognized me me, began in loud terms to berate the president in dehumanizing terms. I brought your book out and put it on the table. It had no impact on him, and so I finally moved. I think he was doing it for my benefit, but he was engaged in someone with whom he was not traveling. And I thought to myself, this is why I despair of your project, Arthur. I think poisoned.
It's not that you think we're poisoned, Hugh. We are poisoned. And that's why I wrote the book. Periodically, this happens in the United States, usually in the decade or decade and a half following a financial crisis, when the rewards of economic growth, America's promise, that tends to be highly uneven, going to the top 20% of the income distribution. We have populism, we have polarization, and we have, I mean, the amazing thing to me, Hugh, I mean, to talk about how poisoned we are, one in six Americans has stopped talking to a family member or close friend because of politics. You know, you and I both know that love is the nuclear fuel of happiness, and we have a happiness catastrophe because of this polarization. It's not just about politics, it's about love.
There are two standout statistics in the book Love Your Enemies by Arthur Brooks. I encourage you to get it, not only for yourself, but for your family, friends, and anyone with whom you've stopped talking. One is that one in six people have stopped talking to a family member as a result of politics. The other is that 72,000 people died of overdose in 2017.
Yeah, no, that's right. And these are, you know, the despair that's coming across the country is we're lashing out at other people with whom we have ideological differences. I mean, Hugh, just ideological differences. I mean, I realize that we all have very strong opinions. You and I are strong conservatives, both of us. We agree on, as far as I can tell, almost every issue. And yet, and as is the case in our lives, everybody's life, everybody listening to us, if I ask for a show of hands, although this is the radio so we can't see, I will ask our listeners, how many of you love somebody with whom you disagree politically? 100% of these hands are going up right now. And this is very profound and very important. We're not talking to people with whom we disagree politically because we've blown that up in this polarized environment. We've turned ideological differences into the material of hate, of, no, contempt, which is even worse.
This is in fact the theme of the book Love Your Enemies, that a culture of contempt will kill the people who indulge it, but it's also difficult to eradicate once it takes root. Your analogy to Nazi Germany and the dehumanizing rhetoric used against rats there, it is now not just a province of the left or right. It is on both extremes, and it is spreading.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Another statistic in the book that really stood out for me is that 93% of Americans hate how divided we've become, and yet they participate in it because of a form of addiction. In the book, I go through the brain science of the addiction to contempt toward our fellow men.
I want to come back to that, but first I'd like for you to explain in your inimitable fashion motive attribution asymmetry. It's a new term to me. It's one I'm internalizing because it seems to me to be appropriate. Yeah, as well as confirmation bias, but motive attribution asymmetry is a genuinely new and I think important term for people to understand.
So motive attribution asymmetry, kind of a fancy set of terms, is cooked up by professional academics because, you know, we got to get tenure somehow, right?
Huh.
But it was political scientists have found cases, particularly after warfare, when people are the Palestinians and Israelis, for example, where both sides feel that they are motivated by love, but that the other side is motivated by hatred toward them. Now, both sides can't be right. Both can be wrong, but both sides can't be right. Now, the reason that I bring up motive attribution asymmetry in this book is because for the first time since they've been keeping records on this subject, that political scientists find that Democrats and Republicans have the same level of motive attribution asymmetry. I am motivated by love. They are motivated by hatred. The same level as the Palestinians and Israelis in that conflict in the Middle East. It's incredible. We simply can't attribute human characteristics to the other side anymore. Now, it doesn't say, I'm not saying that both sides are right or we need mushy moderation, but that's catastrophic.
It is catastrophic, but the way out is, to me, improbable. Let's begin with the obvious thing, which is that anonymity is a killer online. It kills the people who wield it. It kills the people against whom it is wielded. But it is everywhere. And I don't see any major market leader moving to remove anonymity as a feature of their platform because it creates clicks.
Yeah, no, that's right. Anonymity is when you have, it's actually two things simultaneously. When you have mechanisms like social media, which can massively propagate the message of people, ordinary people, everybody can be a columnist on the scale of Krauthammer, of George Will, of Hugh Hewitt. Everybody can do it on social media simply because the stuff can get around. And then if you take the dehumanization that comes because you're anonymous, and by the way, everybody knows that when you dehumanize another person, take away their humanity, you can do terrible things to them. The point that I make in this book is that when we are anonymous ourselves, when we choose to be anonymous online, we dehumanize ourselves. We subtract our own humanity, and as such, we are choosing to behave worse than we ordinarily would as people. This is a scourge. This is an epidemic, a cancer, a metastasis on the body politic, but one of the key things I point out, and this is the very practical argument in the book, this is what should concern people just as much. It makes us unpersuasive. If we're trying to be in the business of convincing people that our point of view is correct, we're not going to do it. On the contrary, we're going to get a reaction called the boomerang effect that takes people who disagree with us and pushes them in the other direction. And here's the worst part of all, the more we are anonymous, the more we are hateful, the more we are contemptuous, the less happy our lives are going to be. And I've got the proof in this book.
My full interview with Arthur Brooks is available at townhallreview.com and on our podcast. Sign up at townhallreview.com. Get a daily dose of the best in conservative talk radio. Coming up.
In the book, I reveal stories I've never told before, but my parents could not make the $96 a month rent. Anytime that you are going to try and break the status quo and go against the grain, the forces of nature are against you.
A coffee merchant aspires for a higher calling. When we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Trump presidency is perhaps the ultimate outsider presidency. The man whose first public office was President of the United States. Another businessman outsider is looking to challenge President Trump. But more immediately, Howard Schultz as a candidate will be a threat to a leftward-leaning cast of Democratic candidates. For conservatives, the former Starbucks CEO as president gives pause, perhaps a result of so many years of preaching / PC activism from Starbucks. Howard Schultz is out with a new book, an autobiography titled From the Ground Up. He was a recent guest on my radio show. Let me go to a few interesting details. My favorite line in the book is on page 58. When your father-in-law says to you, son, you need to get a job.
What happened was my wife, Sherry, was 8 months pregnant with our first child. She was still working and earning a salary. I was trying to start Starbucks, and he took me for a walk and said respectfully, I think you need to get a job. You've got a hobby, and you're not taking any money. And I literally started to cry. I came home that night, and when I told Sherry what happened later that night, she said to me that night, there's no way we're going to give up on this dream. It wasn't for her, there'd be no Starbucks, and you'd be talking to somebody else this morning.
It sounds like a very tough childhood. I mean, a very tough childhood. And yet, in the Washington Post this morning, they're saying that it was the country club of projects. How do you respond to this?
Well, I got to tell you, when I saw the headline of country club of projects, I knew they weren't talking about the place that I grew up in. You know, I told a very personal story of the dysfunction and the pressure that I was under living in that apartment and what I experienced as a young boy. But my parents could not make the $96 a month rent. I look at that story, and it's consistent, unfortunately, with other stories that have been written about me in the last few months since I decided to consider running for president as a centrist independent outside of the two-party system. Anytime that you are going to try and break the status quo and go against the grain, the forces of nature are against you.
So, Howard Schultz, why do you think President Trump won in 2016? Everyone was surprised. We were all wrong, wrong, wrong. We did not see it coming. Why do you think he won?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. First of all, we should mention that approximately 100 million Americans did not vote in 2016. Probably apathy, and also they looked at the two choices and they didn't see anything affirmative.
I've seen you again and again out there, and no one talks to you about why you're running. They talk to you about your effect on running.
I think that's true. I think the level of toxicity has risen, unfortunately, to a level of such extreme. What I'm trying to talk about is common sense solutions. We have $22 trillion of national debt. We have an immigration system that's not working. We have a healthcare crisis. through 12 in this country is not what it should be. And so, you know, I'm trying to bring to the public conversation and national discourse the great need we have for bipartisan solutions and common sense solutions. And really, the elephant in the room is leadership.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Generalissimo, Dwayne Patterson. And let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.